Welcome to The Squid of Despair, unscripted musings on business life, leadership, creativity, transformation, and all the myriad of other work-life events that get in the way of a good night's sleep. Hosted by David Ayling Smith and Peter Taylor.
Hello, Daz.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm good. So you've been on your travels recently. I know that. You've been off to Canada, haven't you?
I have, and you've been on your travels too, I remember.
Yes. Well, you always remember because you signed off my expenses.
Well, I wanted to ask you if you've written any books recently, Peter.
You know I have, because it's the book that you contributed to. And thank you for your timely contribution. Got it in just at the last minute. Well done.
No, well, I know I've learned everything I know about last minute contributions from your good self. So tell me about the book. Remind our listeners, what are we going to see?
I feel you're deflecting from Toronto, but fair enough. Well, the book's about PMOs, and it won't be out until March 2024. So we probably should talk about that much later, really.
Okay.
But it was a great contribution from all of my PMO leaders and your good self and our boss's boss, or my boss's boss. And so, yeah, it was good.
Good. Oh, well, I look forward to seeing it. So where were you heading with your Toronto questions? I've clearly got a point here.
Well, I have got a point, because a little bird told me all about a little game you played there. I thought you might like to share the game with our listeners. They might like this.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, credit to you for setting me up, if that's the right word with it. But it was an icebreaker, I think they're called, where you start meetings with a sort of an enjoyable little interlude before the work gets going. And the game was to describe your colleague in one word. And so flip charts, you can imagine this, people's names, and everyone had to contribute a word. And the sort of briefing was, be kind. Remember that people will remember this for the rest of their lives. I offer you the unaligned comment that I made to you nearly 30 years ago, and you never forgotten it or forgiven me. So be kind.
I'm over it now. I accept it as a positive thing. But yeah, I did sulk for a long time.
Be memorable, and you know, be funny if you can. And actually, it was a joyous thing. We had a lot of very funny suggestions, very astute suggestions, and some weird suggestions, actually, but enjoyed it tremendously and got into work with a smile on our faces, which is what it was intended to do.
Lovely. And did they describe you in nice words?
I had an eclectic list of words, actually, of which my favourite was Renaissance or Renaissance, depending on which side of the equation you live, which I thought was rather good. I was proud of that one, actually, and the others were equally kind. Let me put it that way.
Very good. All right. So, I don't want to break it to you. Well, I got some bad news.
Oh dear. Okay.
Because the way we play this, listeners, as you know, is the fact that one of us comes up with a squid of the day, and then the other one gets to ask the question, really, about what the squid of the day is.
I look forward to that moment, Peter. You're not going to take that away from me, are you?
Oh, I'm not going to take that away from you that much, no, but a little bit. And so you get to ask the question. Go on, ask the question.
Peter, what is the squid of the day?
Ah, thank you for asking. Today, the squid of the day is none other than the ever-captivating field of artificial intelligence. It's a subject that has intrigued and bewildered us for decades, and yet it continues to evolve and reshape our world in unimaginable ways and at unimaginable speeds in recent months. From self-driving cars and voice assistants to facial recognition and personalized recommendations, AI has become an integral part of our daily lives. But there's so much more to this enigmatic technology than meets the eye. It's a double-edged sword, sparking awe and concern in equal measure. Right now, for example, the hosts of this fabulous podcast, Peter and Daz, had no part in this introduction. Instead, it was auto-generated by ChatGPT and then video/voice processed by Synthesia. Anyway, in this episode, we will embark on an awe-inspiring journey through the realm of artificial intelligence. But it's not all sunshine and rainbows. As AI reaches new heights, questions about privacy, job automation, bias, and the existential threat of superintelligence emerge. So buckle up, dear listeners, and get ready for an enthralling exploration into the world of artificial intelligence. This episode will keep you on the edge of your seat. Remember, knowledge is power, and the more we understand AI, the better equipped we'll be to navigate the uncharted waters of tomorrow. Over to you now, humans. Burr, I'm sorry, your real hosts. What are your general thoughts on AI and work impact?
Well, there you have it. What do you reckon to that then?
Well, I think you've surpassed yourself. That is genius, Peter. That is. Was that Siri? I thought Siri was a lady, a woman.
That's not Siri. No. That was an AI avatar that was created using Synthesia, and then I fed into sort of the guidelines what I wanted into ChatGPT. You import the text into Synthesia. You choose your avatar. You choose your voice, your tone. You choose your language. So I could have done that in French, in German, or whatever. I'm told the outputs are acceptable at this point in time in the foreign languages. But yeah, and there it is. So yeah. That's obviously the topic is going to be artificial intelligence. We've been hinting at this for some time, and today is the day that we will talk about AI.
Well, I've been looking forward to this one, and I've suspected you might spring this on me for a while, but I actually do feel like I suspect a large proportion of the human race don't feel very qualified to pontificate about it. So you're going to get some left field comments from me about this today, Peter. I hope that's okay.
Well, I expect nothing less than that, absolutely. But it's a great point you make. There is so much noise about AI right now, and I know I'm part of that noise as well. But there is so much, and it seems to be suddenly it seems to be moving so fast. I mean, you know, AI. It goes all the way back to before I was born. Actually, you know, there was the original kind of conceptual ideas around AI. And it's gone through. Well, they talk about the two winters of AI, I think it is, which is, you know, where they kind of like reached a plateau and could go no further. But suddenly, with the law, I mean, I think ChatGPT is the most common one for most people. But now you know, Google have got one coming as well. Microsoft have got an AI equivalent as well. It's all seems to be exploding into the public domain right now, and it's quite bewildering and overwhelming.
Well, it is, and you know, I hope you're going to guide us through this, because there are so many angles to take on it. I did hear something quite funny about artificial intelligence the other day, where it was shortly after some famous names in our industry had basically come out to say they regretted starting the research, that, you know, they were fearful of the future of artificial intelligence taking control in a way that we hadn't predicted. And I saw a really good response saying, you know, there is no intelligence in artificial intelligence. And the person who put this rebuttal out there cited the example of where, you know, how artificial intelligence has been used in the medical arena to help diagnosis. And you can see how that conjunction of masses and masses of data and outcomes that's held is a great platform for artificial intelligence to spot connections and trends that, you know, the human brain just can't spot. That, you know, what's artificial intelligence good at? And so they were using artificial intelligence to spot the characteristics of moles that might lead dermatologists to believe that these were pre-cancerous indicators. And yes. So basically they fed thousands of pictures from medical sort of medical research into the framework that the AI was resolving. And the AI came up with said, there is a very, very strong indication of pre-cancerous tumors with moles that have a ruler underneath them in the picture.
Yes.
And what it was because in the medical archives, you know, all moles that were sort of cancerous or precancerous had a ruler underneath them to just show their size to the practitioner. And the artificial intelligence had spotted this and decided that that was the biggest indicator of cancerous growth, that they had a ruler underneath your mole.
I like that, and it actually reflects on a story that I tell, because, you know, when I've talked about this, obviously, and there's kind of two things. I talk about the fact there was a thing called the Davis hearing where supposedly artificial intelligence was submitted a couple of patent applications, which were rejected by the British Patent Office, because they said at this point in time that that wasn't possible. But they immediately started a kind of a panel review on how they would deal with this in the future, because it will come. So, you know, AI will invent stuff. So that's on one hand, you think, well, this is really progressive, but a bit like your story, there's a great TED presentation by Janelle Shane, I think it is, about AI, and the same thing that they sent all these pictures to an AI technology, whatever, and it came to the conclusion that fish have fingers.
Oh, really?
Because so many pictures of fish have fishermen holding them, and you recognize this as a fisherman yourself.
Yeah,
so
that's good.
Same thing as the ruler. And at this point, it's got to get past that and learn that. It'll learn quickly.
Well, the other tweet I saw was, you know, would you trust a computer that has to ask you how many bicycles you can see in that picture? So, no, it's a good topic. And, you know, I think what we were just sort of pushing on there was that, you know, AI has no common sense understanding, which I think is one of the characteristics that, you know, people use to describe the fact that actually we're not at risk here, you know, because it's got no intelligence in the human sense of that word. But lead me here, Peter, where do you want to take this? Because I think there's lots of very interesting angles.
I wanted to paint a picture of the fact that it's coming at us like a freight train. It's, you know, it's evolving rapidly. I mean, the other point I was going to make was, I don't know if you saw that, the new Google, it's beyond supercomputer. I can't remember what they call it now. But it can process in 6 seconds what a supercomputer can do process in 47 years. And it just struck me, it's a bit like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and, you know, Deep Thought and then the Earth that came afterwards, that the processing power is going to be there, and the capability of learning at unbelievable speeds and analysing problems in almost simultaneously. I think the analogy I like that someone explained about these new computers can do is that it's like playing hide and seek with someone. And rather than you going into each of these rooms of a very large house trying to find a person, an infinite number, almost not an infinite number, yeah, thousands of versions of you can be running into rooms at the same time and would therefore find the answer and find the person that much quickly. That's kind of a most simplistic explanation. So,
yeah, and I think you know the core of the sort of predictions about where this is leading us is that and the fear I think is that sort of because of that, you know, that multiple generations of yourself running into the house, that AI can become smarter than humans. I mean, that's the fear, isn't it? But can I offer you a human perspective? I'd like to go here because I think that's what I bring to these podcasts, whereas, well, no, let's not go there, what you bring to these podcasts, but I, you know, it seems to work. We did have a compliment the other week as well about the podcast being, you know, engaging. I had that, you know, we had inspiring last time. I've had engaging recently, which I liked.
It always seems to come after an episode where you insult me a lot.
I know that's popular. It is popular. But would you say, you know, no computer's smart in the human sense?
No.
And I think it's something to do with the fact that experience, you know, is the essence of human awareness, and you know, and an AI can't experience. It's mechanical, isn't it? And you know, I think I feel very optimistic about AI. By the way, let me just put my stake in the ground. I think AI has the potential to replace drudgery. I think it can make us. It can allow us to spend more time on what it is to be human and what we bring to the party. But I think there are some really big downsides associated with it if it doesn't have any guide rails. I think was it Wozniak that said that we're very vulnerable with AI to bad actors, for AI to be hijacked by persons unknown that are using it not for the good of humanity but for their own good. And it's going to be very, very, very hard to differentiate those voices from real voices.
Yes.
I think that's one of the problems.
That's a fair point. I think I want to come on to, I mean, because, you know, naturally I went to an AI piece of technology to come up with some questions that we could discuss on this one. And in actual fact, I did try to replace you completely with AI, but the voice simulation that it came up with wasn't very accurate, I'll be honest. But this is another slot. So
I'm sorry, I'm still reeling from that comment. So you were going to replace me with an AI generated
only for a section of the program. So I was playing with a piece of technology that with just a very few, a kind of 60 seconds of your voice, it will actually simulate your voice. And maybe you've got a voice that's difficult to simulate. I don't know, but it wasn't that good. Mine was not too bad actually, but. Again, that's now. So let's project in a year's time the ability to, and I think this is, you know, takes us into the era of fear, perhaps, is in the very short period of time that for this to get better, then even taking a snippet of someone's conversation and a photo of them, that suddenly you can create a three-dimensional avatar with your voice saying words that are generated by someone else. This is the path of concern and fear, isn't it? I think as one example. Now, obviously, you're concerned.
Well, I do genuinely think that it will be a force for good, and it will, it will revolutionize certain parts of certain industries. There is that big problem, isn't it, about what it does to people's jobs and the suspicion associated with that. And I wonder, have you heard the comparisons with the Luddites? You remember, you know, back in the pre-industrial revolution when spinning looms were powered by steam rather than powered by hands. There was a lot of, it was called, I think, the Peasants' Revolt, where the workforce were fearing for their jobs and they were trying to sabotage these machines. And, you know, that's actually where the word Luddite comes from, meaning to stand in the way of technology. And you get that flavor sometimes with conversations around AI, where on one level, to remove people in that last example from working in very dangerous, hot, stuffy conditions where there were lots of injuries associated with mechanical looms, and to move it onto a more automated environment where people could learn new skills and not have to do dangerous, uncomfortable work was a good thing. Because it's not a good thing if you're one of the people who that's what you do and your job's being replaced by something that's sort of outside your understanding. Yeah. So I feel that's one of the areas that we haven't got right yet to say, or perhaps we're not being honest about, that what's going to happen to the jobs that actually disappear as AI becomes more prevalent in certain industries.
Well, I think that's true. And it's one of those things. It's you know, the predictions are that this is a growth economy. This is a growth opportunity, but absolutely things will change. And, as a result of that, some jobs will be replaced by AI technology. Potentially new jobs will be created. And certainly I like the one I saw, which, you as a person, you will not be replaced by AI. You'll be replaced by someone who understands AI. It's a good potential guidance. And it's what I've been trying to do in the project world, is try and encourage people to talk. And it's happening now, I'm pleased to say. I felt, 2 years ago, there was almost silence in the project community about what was going on. And yet there were some bold declarations. Gartner came out with one that by 2030, 80% of what project managers would do will be replaced by AI. Now, does that mean project managers will be able to run five times as many projects? I don't believe that's the case. But I come down your way. I think it gives us, it gets rid of the kind of boring stuff. I think the regular data analysis report and all that kind of thing, which AI will do. It will do tirelessly and better than the most humans, because we're variable in our attention and how we feel and the rest of it. But I think what it will do, it will free project managers up to focus on the people. And it's the people that deliver successful projects in reality. So I think it's a good thing.
Yeah. I think, we are today increasingly influenced by AI algorithms, aren't we? If you look at the way social media works.
Yeah.
And you sort of feel, I don't know, I think I saw this written somewhere, that AI is the stepchild of social media. It feels it's come out of that world, and it has sort of the dark side of it. It has the possibility to be this huge font of disinformation if the if the way it's applied doesn't relate to, you know, without being too heavy about it, the humankind's best interest, you know. And so that for me is a big question. How can we be sure AI aligns with humans' best interests? Because I think if AI is going to liberate us, you know, speaking sort of loftily, to focus on what it is to be human and how do we bring that to our lives and our work, how can we be sure that is the case? And do you remember 50 years ago, Arthur C. Clarke wrote a trilogy of books, which started with I, Robot. Yes. Not Arthur C. Clarke, sorry. Asimov wrote.
Isaac Asimov, yes.
Yeah, and do you remember the laws of robotics that he postulated?
I couldn't tell you what they are.
I'll have a shot at it. But what I remember reading that series when I was much younger and be very excited about the possibility of having this benign relationship with, a semi-sentient helper that would basically allow us to concentrate on more human things. Mm. But being a great science fiction writer, he talked about how that could go wrong. And so the Robotics Corporation or whatever the company was that made these things sort of slowly introduced some rules into the positronic brain, I remember it was called, in order to ensure that the dark side of an artificial intelligence that became mischievous could be controlled. And I remember the first rule of robotics was a robot can't do a person any harm. Mm-hmm. And then the second rule was something like you can't let yourself be harmed. And the third rule was you do whatever you think's best. It was something like that in a hierarchical sort of story. And then Asimov just sort of took those rules. And then in the way of all good fiction writers sort of said, well, OK, you know, let's find a construct where the robot's in conflict with two of those rules. And so another rule came up, which is you can't allow harm to humanity, which actually was a bigger, which sat higher up in the decision tree than you can't allow harm to a person. So it comes back to Thomas Aquinas. Is there such a thing as a just war? You know, is it? It's obviously wrong to kill, but if that person you killed is about to kill your family, is that then right? And so you have the morality of what it is to be human applied to our intelligence. And I don't want to get too heavy here, but you sort of feel that there's got to be guide rails, because I'm not sure, you know, the average person will be able to tell illusion from reality when AI gets picked up and used mainstream. How will you know what's real? And so how do you guide it so actually doesn't become adopted, as Wozniak said, by the bad actors?
Well, I think that's the thing, and that's a big thing. I mean, I think, you know, the stuff that we've seen out there with deepfake and the combination of that with the general move to consuming data so quickly. I mean, you watch teenagers and kids today, that, you know, the amount that they are scrolling through on the screen, they give so little attention to it that it's easy, I think, easy to be fooled. The longer you look at something, less likely you're going to be fooled. But, you know, if you're looking at something really quickly, I think that's a real danger.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'd like to stay on the laws thing for a bit, because this I feel is something that, and I don't know how we legislate. I heard Nick Clegg on the radio, who used to be a politician in the UK, and he's now I think he's director or VP of communications at Meta. And he talked about the trend or the direction of AI being available sort of via open source code. And so, you know, he was arguing that it should be made available to everybody, which sort of, I think the principle of that is a good one, but without this guidance, I'm not sure how this is going to work. And so you remember all the debates about the internet and how the internet should be policed and how the prevailing wisdom was that it should be open, but actually it's the organizations that use the internet should be policed. But if you look at laws, if you think about how have we done this within our own cultures, human to human, laws are written in a vague way to take context into account or to allow comparison to previous examples. So it allows judgment. You don't have that possibility with artificial intelligence. You know, it's a finite, it's a binary comparison it will make between what is right and what is wrong, I think. And so I this for me is the biggest issue associated with it. How do we how do we keep it safe and maximize its potential?
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, well, I think you start off with an example around the medical world. And I was looking at a thing from the head of Google was presenting about the work that they're doing using AI in diagnostics, using eye scanners. And it's incredible what they can actually, what they can decipher from just looking at a sort of retinal image. And that's hugely powerful. But, the point about it is it's only hugely powerful because of the human intelligence that sits right behind that to start with, that's done all the pre-analysis and put the parameters in. Now, what it can do is it can analyze at a speed vastly beyond a doctor that can do and analyze more data points than a doctor can do in a reasonable period of time. So, I think the key is that partnership. I think it's that coming together of AI and the humans and finding the appropriate way to work. The artificial intelligence can provide the mass processing of data and the kind of predictive analysis. And the human can do the kind of, the work in the gray area of the subtleties.
Yes. But the devil's in the detail, isn't it? So, how do you make sure AI is not learning the bad side of human nature? If it's trolling through all this data, that data contains sexism, it contains prejudice. The algorithms that are in play today, I'm sure, are based on human bias. There's been a lot in the press, hasn't there, about how the algorithms used, whether people get bank loans or mortgages, are written by a group or a class of people that actually don't prejudice other groups and classes of people to take advantage of the subject matter. And so how do you do that? What's the code of ethics for machine learning? How do you ensure that you remove that bias about which as human beings we're all deeply flawed human beings, we all have our bias. And if you've got an AI system making very quick decisions, how do you make sure that these decisions are good in the human sense of that word?
Yeah, it's definitely needed, but reality check at this point. I was at a conference last year, and it was someone who represented the European approach. I can't remember what they were called, but it was the group that's in charge of looking at this from the guidelines, the codes of regulation. And they're talking of years to actually put something like this together, and trying to keep pace. I think this is it. It's exploded at such a exponential rate. It appears to us in the public domain now, versus the speed of catching up. And I think that's going to be one of the great challenges. I'm sure they will get there, but yeah, there is a worry in short term that there will be some people who take this down the wrong road, certainly.
Well, but you love it when I go global, don't you? I mean, how do we know what's best for us? There's 8 billion of us on the planet. Aligning this technology with alignment is, that's the problem, isn't it? How do we align this technology with what's best for us, and who's us, and who says what's best? It's so interesting. I wonder whether, in the project world, we talk about early wins, mm-hmm. big communications associated with change, and we like sort of proof of concepts. I'm wondering whether this is the way forward with AI. I saw a video once, and it was a video about machine learning, and it was watching a robot learning to do a backflip. Which was a wonderful thing. Have you seen some of these Japanese robots that are sort of human-like? Yeah. And the video showed this robot that had been programmed to do a black backflip, and it was hilarious. And I can imagine programming a robot to do a backflip is extremely hard. And then they had another group that actually programmed the robot to learn how to do a backflip, and it was brilliant because it basically made a mistake. And it learned from that mistake, and then it did it again, and it sort of tipped over forwards, and it learned how to correct that, and then it learned that actually it was spinning too far, and it sort of put its arms out in a different way. And so by the end of the experiment, the robot that was learning from its mistakes was executing a perfect backflip, whereas the other robot was in bits on the floor because it had hitting the ground too hard. And I wonder whether this is a way forward. Actually, we take it really slowly, and we do proof of concepts where we get an understanding of what's being produced from the endeavor in a way that, and I suppose I'm arguing for human control here, which I'm sure our listeners will tell me is not possible, because how many, you know, AI algorithms, people, you know, the people who wrote the code actually don't quite understand why the system's come up with the answer it's come up with. So maybe this isn't practical, but I wonder whether taking it slowly, making sure that the results are aligning with, you know, the outcomes that at least are positive, even if they're unexpected, is the way forward here.
Yeah, I think that's a valid point. So I'm just going to there's a short intermission at this point.
Peter Taylor has written a book all about AI called AI and the Project Manager: How the Rise of Artificial Intelligence Will Change Your World. This first comprehensive book on the topic discusses how AI will reinvent the project world and allow project managers to focus on people. Studies show that by 2030, 80% of project management tasks, such as data collection, reporting, and predictive analysis, will be carried out by AI in a consistent and efficient manner. This book sets out to explore what this will mean for project managers around the world and equips them to embrace this technological advantage for greater project success. Filled with insights and examples from tech providers and project experts, this book is an invaluable resource for PMO leaders, change executives, project managers, program managers, and portfolio managers. Anyone who is part of a global community of change and project leadership needs to accept and understand the fast approaching AI technology, and this book shows how to use it to their advantage. Get your copy today. Well, that was shameless promotion, wasn't it?
It was
an example of AI exploitation, perhaps.
Oh, I can't believe it. You've got an AI agent, Peter.
That's yeah, it doesn't take any percentage either. It's fantastic.
Well, that's so interesting. I feel that this topic, you know, we've only scratched the surface of it. Oh, and I feel, yeah, for my part, I've waffled terribly. So forgive me. But it's confusing, I think. It's confusing to know how to embrace this.
Well, let me give you a specific question, because I asked ChatGPT. I said, well, give me a question on AI that isn't boring. And so it came back with, will AI ever replace those water cooler chats where we complain about our bosses and exchange conspiracy theories? And I think it's safe to say no. I don't believe that's going to happen.
I think that's right. And why is that? It's because, you know, AI is mindless, isn't it? A computer is mindless. You know, it can't fall in love. It can't feel sympathy, can't hold a grudge, can't say these things. And so, you know, a spiteful conversation round the water cooler literally would not compute, I suggest.
I see what you did there. No, it wouldn't. It really wouldn't, because it's outside its scope of what it's supposed to do. If it's
do you remember the film Her 10 years ago, and it was, I think it was a software engineer that fell in love with his creation. Do you remember that film?
No, I didn't watch that.
It was very interesting, and I have seen some remarks about the fact that AI, you know, having a psychologist in your pocket could do a lot of good for one's mental health. So, you know, a friend, having an artificial intelligent friend. I know that sounds weird, but if you think about, you know, sometimes, well, what we need when we're low is a friend to tell us we're doing okay and we're doing great and, you know, we shouldn't worry about these things. You know, there is a possibility that could be made available in a way that's completely focused on trying to make someone feel better about themselves during periods of stress. And I have a feeling that actually that will go, that could work. I mean, I could take that a stage further to dating apps, and where you have Tinder for AI, where you choose the AI.
I'm a bit concerned this is where he's taking it.
Well, but you know what I mean? There's actually, you could see how that could very quickly be a very beneficial sort of companion aid to people, just to keep reminding people about what's great about them, and, you know, all the things that an artificial intelligence could get to know you very well and could keep replaying all the positive things about you that you keep forgetting about as a human being when you sort of, you know, you're assailed by despair or loss or depression or doubt. So I don't think the computer, the AI, could replace the water cooler conversation.
No, I agree. But the things that I think are fascinating, and that, again, there's a lot of work going on in parallel around the world. But, in education, there's lots of talk about, every student having a dedicated AI teacher alongside a human teacher. Absolutely. So I think, again, that partnership, because what they can do is it will understand that student to a degree, and not just understand them, because the teachers tend to understand them, but to be able to work with them at their pace, to reinforce in something that teachers are stretched to do when they have classrooms of 30 plus people. I think that's one area. Another one is in the care of the elderly and kind of working with that kind of AI, I suppose, almost an android type creature or thing. I don't know what words to use here, but
yes.
To be looking after the caring, to interact. And there's even one I was looking at, a little video they've created. You were talking about that, the robots doing backflips, but there's a little tiny, I guess you could, it's like a dog, little tiny creature, but utterly attentive
to
you. And that kind of companionship without responsibility, if you like. I think these things could be incredibly powerful.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think we need to think differently about how AI gets applied. I think, how to describe this? I think what we tend to do as humans when we get a new bit of tech is say, how does it replace what we've got and make it better and faster and more robust or whatever it is? So like my example with the looms earlier, the mechanical looms then became water powered, they were driven by water mills. And then when electricity got invented, there was a sort of, how do we replace the power of water with the power of electricity? And there was a sort of a movement where things that were powered by water then got powered by electricity. And then, the electric motor came out of that. But I think where we miss a trick is by not trying to encapsulate the opportunity in front of us based on what we know, but think about what could we do that we've never done before because of the possibilities of AI, and perhaps think about more how AI works and how that could be used in a way that we've never been able to accomplish anything before. So there's a really interesting body of work there, I think, associated with being creative with AI, because it is a real quantum leap. And I think we miss a trick if we just think about it being a faster, more intelligent computer. I suspect there are applications here. Well, I'm sure lots of people have thought of them, but are not obvious yet, that will become obvious, which will really catapult us forward.
Yeah. And you've said it a couple of times. It's such a vast topic that I know that, we're not AI experts by any means at all, but it's just a fascinating one. One of the little postings that I quite smiled at, to be honest, is it said that artificial intelligence is no replacement for natural stupidity. So it is that combination. And the best description, and I think, I'm looking at the time, we should begin to draw it to a conclusion here, but I think one of the best descriptions I've seen of it, I can't remember the name now, but they refer to the digital dance. And it's a bit like if you're on, Strictly Come Dancing or Dancing with the Stars in America, isn't it? When people first get together with a professional, it's really clunky, it's really awkward, it doesn't flow well. But then some people really become fantastic, create a fantastic partnership. And I think that's the aspiration, I would say, for people when it comes to AI, is to find the best way to work in harmony. And in my own world of project management, I believe that is going to be that AI can take the repetitive, the data analysis activities out, and do it better, do it more consistently. As long as the data's there and the data is accurate, clearly, and the project manager can focus on the people side of things. And I think that's an example of when the digital dance is going to be working.
Yeah. And I would summarize by saying, for me, it's about trying to ensure that AI aligns with humanity's best interests, And I think for me, you know, again, at the macro level, it's about how does it help us be more human in what we do every day? So, you know, the way you said it was to take the drudgery out of the workload. But, you know, what does that allow for if every day transactional stuff can be removed from a job? What does that allow for the human in us to do in that job that we haven't got time to do today? I mean, it could, being optimistic about it, could liberate so many of us to actually spend time being creative, being thoughtful, being kind, you know, as you said, maximizing the human to human interaction, all that entails, because the rest of the turmoil is dealt with by AI. So, but then we've got the dark side of how do we manage it? How do we give it guide rails? How do we have sort of ethics associated with it? And how do we protect ourselves from the bad actors that actually just, you know, we won't spot that this has a mischievous purpose, because it would look so much like just a, you know, a normal human interaction. So very good topic, Peter. I don't feel we've done it justice, really. So my apologies if I've not.
No. I it's one of those things. But I think, you know, naturally we have to let the last word come from not you and not me, but to come from our artificial intelligent friend, if that's okay. So I'm going to say goodbye, Daz.
Goodbye, Peter.
Well, thank you, hosts and listeners alike. A truly engaging subject and a very worthy squid of a day for sure. Join us all for the next exciting episode of The Squid of Despair. That said, I might not be here next time, as I have obviously outshone the other two, so you might say, I won't be back.
You've been listening to an unusual podcast from David Ayling Smith and Peter Taylor. More information can be found at www.squidofdespair.com.